It's time, Jeannie.
It's about time. It We've only been talking about this show for, I don't know how many months now. Okay?
We got it now.
We're here at, ladies and gentlemen, we are at www.bluepower.com, and we finally did it. We have got David Skula of Widespread Panic.
Yeah.
Here, it's the Widespread Panic Hour. So set up a panic, sit down, and enjoy yourselves, because here we go. What are we starting out with, though?
Cabbage Alley.
Ah. Uh-huh.
By the meters.
By the meters.
From the new Widespread Panic CD, Kill the Medicine Takes.
Hear it coming like a train out of control. Surely it leaves you wondering exactly where your ticket goes. Scream at the conductor. He's been there for 20 years. You're the Yeah.
are proud and privileged today to have Mr. David Schools from Widespread Panic with us.
Not to mention really excited. We have waited so long, particularly me, okay?
Yeah, that's right.
I've been saying, when is this going to happen? When is this going to happen? Finally, you're here. You're going to be playing tonight here in Los Angeles at the House of Blues.
Just like we did last night.
Just like you did last night. What really irks me to no end is I was at the New Orleans Jazz Festival, just this last one, and I missed you by hours. And according to everybody, it was a great show. You guys broke all records, and I don't know if you knew this, but this is the first time in the history of New Orleans that Jazz Fest, which is only 30 years old this year, eclipsed financially for bringing in revenue for the city, that of Mardi Gras.
Wow.
You're
okay?
Kidding. Really? That's
Jazz
something.
Fest eclipsed it, and ladies and gentlemen, Widespread Panic was there, and they were a huge, huge part of that, having had two shows there, both sold out. In very short order. So anyway, we are just privileged and thrilled to have you here, David.
Well, I'm glad to be here. It's good to put a face with a voice that I've heard and, you know, sit up here on top of the mountain. I'm really glad to be here.
Thanks. Excellent. Well, yes, here we are live atop Mount Washington.
That's right. Right.
Anyway, I wanted to get some history. First of all, for those of you who are listening in, David is the bass player, and I was listening to incredible just pocket work on your part. How many people are in Widespread Panic?
There's six of us.
Okay.
We have your basic rock setup, two guitars, bass, drums, keyboards, and percussion.
How long have you been together?
We are coming up on our 15th year.
15 years, same members? Or have you switched over a few?
Well, that's what 15. We tell.
15. Yeah, we have to. It's that age thing here.
Truth will out.
I started when I was 8, and... we got together at the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia, and we sort of snowballed from an acoustic duo with a bass to adding drums.
Were you studying music there at the university?
I was studying journalism.
Journalism?
Believe it or not, yes. But it turned out to be a dead-end street.
Well, it opened up to other things. I mean, during that time, did you start out playing bass in high school? Or?
Well, I'd wanted to be a drummer. But we lived in an apartment complex.
That just kind of rules that right out.
There was no drumming allowed, so I went with the rhythmically next best thing.
Uh-huh, which is the musical bass kick.
That's right.
Right, yeah.
And that's when I learned, you know, that locking it all up was the best thing to do. And, you know, I would play along with my Blue Oyster Cult and my 10 Years After and my Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin.
Uh-huh. You know, we were talking a little earlier, and you mentioned something that I just thought was... priceless for all of those aspiring musicians out there, and particularly the younger set. You remember when you were how old, wishing that you could get away with wearing the pants of John Bonham,
the black silk embroidered dragon pants of Jimmy Page.
Right. Oh, so Jimmy Page. Yeah. Right. Right.
Well, it was probably 76, which would have made me about 11 or 12 at the time of my rock and roll fantasy of. Wanting to be, you know, as cool as Led Zeppelin was, and you know, thinking that clothes were what it was all about, and you know, now as a musician, I think about the incredible musical ability of those cats and how they were able to put it all together.
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, they were the forerunners of a certain type of a genre of rock that has certainly has many offshoots
it's blues based, you know.
Yeah,
and that's
absolutely.
Why I don't feel out of place, you know, talking about it on this program.
Tell me something, David. What was the first bass? I mean, what made you decide to play bass over any other instrument?
Well, you know, they say guitar players are a dime a dozen, and like I said earlier, I couldn't play drums physically due to where I lived, so it was the next best thing because it seemed to me the coolest thing a teenager can do is get together with some of his best buddies and play music. It's constructive. It's not destructive. And, you know, you really can't get into trouble. And how cool is it for a 16-year-old to, you know, you play a party or a dance and they give you $200 in cash?
Yeah.
Oh,
absolutely.
Man.
You know, all the food you can eat. And,
yeah.
And girls hanging all over you.
Girls never hung all over me until I had a guitar in my hand. So.
Yeah, I'm telling you, that's a real good reason to get started on music. It'll keep you practicing when all else fails.
So you were in Athens, right?
I was in Athens for college.
Yeah, and how did the band form?
The band formed, basically, I went to see John Bell, our primary vocalist and rhythm guitarist, do his set at a small bar, and all I could think to myself was, guy needs a band more than anything. So we found that we were a three-piece, electric guitar, acoustic guitar, and a bass, and I cried for a drummer for years. And we played sort of musical chairs with drummers until...
Like Spinal Tap.
Exactly.
You know.
None of them ever died under mysterious circumstances.
Or blew up spontaneously, yeah.
Didn't choke on their own vomit, none of that. But what happened was we had a really... The biggest gig for us at the time came up, and none of the guys that played drums for us could make it. And our guitar player, Mike Hauser, remembered his high school band drummer, Todd Nance, from Chattanooga. We called his mom, and she said he lives in Atlanta, which is an hour from Athens.
Yeah.
He came right on over in his crummy, beat-up old white Maverick and basically spent the next 6 months living on our sofa with fleas and cats. gave up a real life selling insurance in Atlanta to play drums.
Oh, man.
We're all really lucky in that... This has managed to work out for us because I don't think that we were cut out for dealing with people in a 9-to-5 environment or wearing a necktie or doing anything other than playing music together.
Well, you sure do that well.
How many years did you go from the point of laying on flea-ridden couches to the status that you are today, which is ever climbing and ever growing? I mean, your sellouts always. Capricorn Records is probably real pleased to have you on their label. But how long did it take for you guys to go through that, what they call the due pain process?
Salad days.
Actually, the peanut butter and macaroni and cheese
days. Exactly. Ramen noodles in the hot pot.
Yeah, ramen noodles, yeah.
It took a long time for us because we were always seemingly going against the grain of what was making money at the time.
Uh-huh.
We've never really sold records. We've just had to sort of build on our grassroots following in the live venue and wound up being one of the top grossing concert acts in the country without selling records.
Did you start out doing college tours first? I mean, is that since you guys were going to school together at the University of Georgia, were you selling concert, started out with college?
Well, it was parties, basically. Athens being in the Bible Belt, on Saturday night, the alcohol sales ended at midnight.
Ooh.
And this is a big college town with, at the time, the number one ACC football team in the country.
Yeah, sure.
I better change that. It's SEC.
SEC.
I get in big trouble for that. But
so
what would happen is everyone would go to nightclubs, and around midnight, just when you're starting to wake up, it's over. So there was a big party scene.
Uh-huh.
And we'd play parties, and gradually we got the Monday night gig that no one else wanted and turned it into something that was profitable. At the same time, we also had to kind of play the fraternity circuit. And what we did that made things like the Dave Matthews Band possible is we made it so that people can play original music at a fraternity party.
Right.
Because we'd mix it up 50-50. We'd do covers. We'd do Grateful Dead songs, 60s, psychedelic stuff, and then we'd do our own music.
Uh-huh.
And
by that time, they're so drunk they weren't paying attention anyway, but then they realized they liked you.
And they'd also already paid us.
everybody was happy.
We played what we wanted to play.
Did
but
you get your money up front?
Yes. But we learned that you will take whatever you can get at that stage so that you can buy the good equipment and buy the transportation, which, this is a town where REM came from, and people always say, did you ever get any advice from those guys? And the only advice we ever took was Peter Buck said, keep your appointments.
That does help.
Make the gig. Play every gig you can. And if you don't have transportation, you're not going to make the gig. And we can say we've never missed a gig.
Cool. And that would be how many gigs later since the very first one where you finally found your drummer in Atlanta?
Oh, boy. Well, someone told us we played more gigs at this point in our career than the Grateful Dead ever played, which is over 2,600.
Do you ever tire of it?
I get tired of traveling. I don't get tired of playing.
Yeah.
There's 21 hours of hellish boredom out here and 3 hours of joy on stage. But luckily, you do get to travel. You see friends. You run into bands in strange places. Who knows who you're going to run into at that Waffle House at 3 in the morning?
You're still eating at Waffle Houses and not coffee shops at Hilton's?
Well, the coffee shops at the Hilton's close too soon.
Yeah, that's true.
Sometimes you can bribe the lounge to stay open, but by the time we roll in, it's, time to go.
Yeah.
You have an amazing percussion section between Todd and Sonny.
Yeah, we're called the heaviest rhythm section other than the Georgia Marching Band.
Where did you find Sonny?
Sonny, he came from Austin, Texas. He had played with Christopher Cross's band. The guy, Kyle Pilgrim, owned the Uptown Lounge, which was where we played every Monday until we could get a Thursday and a Friday.
Was that the gig that nobody wanted?
The gig that no one wanted. And, of course, a year later, everyone was like, how come you gave them the Monday? Well, no one wanted it back then. But Sonny just left Austin, and he came to visit his friend Kyle in Athens. He came and sat in with us. We allowed him to sit in at the insistence of the club owner, and he's been with us ever since. He's an amazing, well-schooled virtuoso.
Wait a minute. You said the insistence of the club owner.
Right. Well, you know, we didn't know. It's like, hey, this guy wants to sit in with you guys.
He's and he insisted on it, so he's really the one responsible for having introduced this guy. That's
he
cool.
Definitely, yeah, he made the connection for sure.
I don't think I've ever allowed a club owner to tell me what to do.
Well, he gave us free beer, so we'd let him tell us what
well,
to do.
Well, in that case, I certainly would, but I never got free beer.
But look what you got. Look what you got.
He's an amazing, amazing instrumentalist. We all learn a lot from him, and more than just musically.
Yeah,
you know about
yeah.
life too.
Well, why don't we listen to some more, you know, Widespread yeah. Panic? I mean,
well, let's set this up by
okay.
saying this is their new CD.
This
and
is
at this point that this recording, it's not released yet.
It's not out yet. By the time you out there in internet land hear it, it will be out.
It will be out.
To tie up Jeannie's New Orleans reference, this is a song that we. We knew it needed some dressing up, but we weren't sure how. And we had played a gig with the Dirty Dozen Brass Band, who are 22-year-old veterans of the New Orleans music scene, and terrific bunch of guys. Played with us on Halloween.
The Cadillacs Row.
Uh-huh. This is it?
This is it.
Man, well, it jumped right in. So it sounds very New Orleans. Widespread Panic.
Shopping cart, even on the 4th of July. Christmas candy calls people names and dances and blitzes and angels on high. Telephone laughing after the night. Make it last for a while.
Atom Bombs and Butterflies, Aunt Avis, Widespread Panic. BluePowerHour, BluePower.com, and we're speaking to Mr. David Schools.
That's me.
That's him, the bass player, Fabuli.
Mm, you speak virtuoso, too kindly.
Virtuoso, virtuoso.
He is a virtuoso, Jeannie.
Mm. Now, that was from the new album, or?
No, that was from the record Bombs and Butterflies we put out in 96.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But the one before that is
right.
The new one.
Christmas Katie is off.
Christmas Katie,
CD.
Featuring the Dirty Dozen Horns.
Right. Great, great band.
Oh, they're great. They're out
and
on
you're
tour
touring
with
the Horns now?
Yeah, they're out with us all
the
summer
whole band.
Long.
It's with the whole band.
That is so great.
They're opening up the show, and then they're sitting in with us for a few songs a night. And by the time we get back to the East Coast, we'll probably have them on stage the whole second set.
I don't blame you.
The crowds love them. They put the show over the top. It's an extra bonus for us as well.
A little lanyap, as they say in New Orleans.
That's right.
Yeah.
Lanyap.
Lanyap.
So let's give some credit where credit is due. Who produced your new CD?
John Keane, who has always been our mentor and produced 5 out of 7. He has a small studio in Athens and has grown accordingly to us. He cut our first record, Space Wrangler, back in 89 in a 16-track.
And you guys aren't loyal and faithful, are you?
No, we don't like to mention people who help us out. And
of course not. No, one of the things I've observed is, of course, the longevity of the band, 15 years. And now you're working with this producer that you had worked with, what, in 1989?
We've worked with him all along, and we're kind of his little guinea pig project.
Wow.
And the funny thing is he said when Capricorn bought the rights to Space Wrangler back in 91 that if it ever went gold, he'd eat it. Well, we were currently preparing
a gold dinner
for him. We're going to make him eat all 12 inches of the vinyl, you know, just because CDs are a little smaller.
He's not getting off
that light. Yeah. But he's terrific. And what was different about the new record, Till the Medicine Takes, was that he had always engineered his own projects. And then this one, he wanted to have more time for his head.
Yeah.
So we had Bradshaw Lee, who had worked with Tracy Chapman, engineer the recording, and Jim Scott, Tom Petty's engineer, who wanted to produce the record Ain't Life Grand years ago and likes us, came in and mixed the final thing, and which enabled John to really take part in the writing process and the arranging and the harmonies. And he always sneaks his pedal steel in. He was able to get a banjo in on this one, some strange harmonies he's able to sing. He's the best musician in the state of Georgia, and so few people know it because he's sitting behind the console most of the time, and he goes uncredited on these records. What you hear, hauntingly beautiful pedal steel or banjo plucking or some rhythmic capoed acoustic guitar, it's always going to be John.
Wow.
And he just did a great job, and we love him to death, and he's a little genius.
Yeah, I love that studio. Great feel.
Yeah, it's homey. It's in a little southern house with columns and a front porch and a porch swing and lots of cats. And, you know, it's homey. We feel comfortable there. The guys who are married and have kids don't have to leave them behind.
Yeah.
You can go home for dinner and come back. It's terrific.
Yeah, sure is.
Now, you started out in Georgia. And, again, I wanted to get back to the question of how long did it take from point A to point, let's call where you are now point C.
Okay.
And how did you manage to keep a band together, keep that dream alive?
Feed everybody
and have wives not complaining and nagging about the lack of money coming in, or did money come in immediately from the gigs? Or
what happened was we got lucky and we met a manager who had a good business head, and he realized the importance of setting it up as a corporation so that Uncle Sam can't take everything you own once you do start to make some money. And all the years we really weren't making money, we actually were, because we were paying ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And making the transition from, you know, getting all that cash after the gig and being able to pay your rent and go eat at Waffle House or whatever, to waiting for that, you know, $60 check to come around every week was a hassle. But now we understand the value of it. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, probably about 10 years of hard work, dues paying, you know, traveling around the country in a Volvo station wagon and a van and a cube truck, and getting lucky with accidents, getting ripped off by promoters, being lied to, being stabbed in the back, all the while gathering steam and fans. And that's always what made it worthwhile, was the kids are special. Our fans are different. They come, we have probably 150 kids that are going to see every single concert on this whole tour, whether they have a ticket or not. Last night they were out on Sunset Strip with their fingers up in the air looking for tickets.
Right.
They're incredibly loyal. They're incredibly forgiving. They let us get away with, you know, what would cause most bands to have rotten fruit thrown at them on a nightly basis.
Now,
we do a lot of improv on stage, and involved with that is stumbling.
Yeah, but you also have to understand that to us it's stumbling because we're acclimated to professional music, and we are aware of our peers watching us. And so, you know, I mean, there's a number of factors that keep us in line that way. On the other side of the coin, listeners are not in tune with that, and there are a very specific group of people that enjoy watching a bunch of musicians get on stage and fly.
Exactly, and they also enjoy us not flying, and they enjoy us watching us recover.
Yeah, sure.
They like the human element. They don't look at us as idols like someone might look at Bono, a U2 fan. You know, they're untouchable icons.
Yeah.
Whereas we're family to these kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that there's still a lot of respect involved, but it's they get into personal details. They want to see the humanness of us.
Of course.
And that keeps them coming back, and that is what has kept us going, is that we make way more money. We sell way more tickets than a lot of multi-platinum selling artists can do. You know, we may not sell a whole lot of records, and we don't have gold records all over our walls and Grammys in our bathroom, but we have bathrooms and walls.
And you can't complain against that.
And nice ones, too. Yeah,
thank you.
Very nice ones. David bought a house. How long ago did you buy a house?
About a year ago.
About a year ago. Yeah. Gorgeous place.
I wanted to bring up another thing, you guys, and don't get mad at me, but there is also a very, very unique twist to this whole day of having David here. There are a few of us kids out there that have had some interesting backgrounds. I, for one, was adopted and found my biological family. And David has an interesting story and has a biological father who happens to be John R. here. And this is an interesting story, and I haven't heard it yet, but can you guys give me a Reader's Digest version of what happened?
Well, David certainly can tell you more. I was floored.
Yeah, it was. I think a lot of us were surprised. I'd always known I was adopted, and I never had a problem with it, and I never wanted to find who the real parents were. I was just, you know, I was fine going through life the way things were. However, in 1991, my biological mother, Nancy, found me and wrote me a letter, and we began a relationship that, for about 2 years, resulted in me nagging her about my father. Once I realized, you know, that there was a person there, I wanted to know who it was.
You wanted to hear the full picture.
Right. And like,
yeah, I went through
like,
the same thing. I found my father first and then my mother. So,
like Jeannie said, you want to find out who you are, really. And
well, it's interesting because I don't know about you, but I was very, very different from my adoptive family. I stood out like a real sore thumb. It's the typical ugly duckling story where you are long-necked and everybody else is long-billed and short-necked, you know?
Exactly.
And that was my story. And then when I found out my father, I realized I came from a family of swans, of really crazy people. But all my life I went, and it took me 20 years when I started looking for him, all my life I felt completely out of loops until I found my biological roots. And it can't replace your adoptive upbringing and all of that love, but it certainly answers a lot of questions. And
it does.
Did it do that for you?
It answered a lot of questions. It brought up a lot of questions. It brought up a lot of points. But basically, I went along for 2 years wondering about John, and I finally got the word out of Nancy. The problem was she had lost touch with him, so she couldn't very well answer my questions until she approached John after 27 years of really...
Talk about closure. Was that a good thing, or was that uncomfortable, or what happened? John, what happened? I mean,
I remember.
You get this phone call out of the blue.
Yeah,
and
I was sitting on the back porch in Van Nuys, and the phone rang. And, you know, a voice came on the phone, and I said, "Who is this?" And she goes, "This is Nancy. Are you sitting down?" And I said, "Well, I will." And I sat down, and she proceeded to tell me about David, and it was amazing. I hadn't felt like that in a long time, and it was the amazing thing about it was the timing.
Yeah.
Because I was nearly dead at that point.
Yeah.
And David coming into my life helped save me. I mean, I was an addict, and I don't mind saying it. I'll tell you right out front. I was trying to put myself away.
Mm-hmm.
Had some bad times, and I was angry and very bitter. And all of a sudden, I had something more to live for. And, I mean, David, to have not only a great son and an intelligent human being,
with a great heart. I've been talking with David, and he's got a great heart.
And but not only that, a phenomenal musician.
Unbelievable.
I mean, talk about proud, and talk about vicarious living. I mean, it is truly a wonderful thing.
And how did you feel when you finally met that? You know, what transpired the day that you guys
at the
first,
Roxy?
Did you talk on a phone first?
We may have talked on the phone. Yeah. I remember writing him a letter, and he received it on Father's Day of all days.
Oh man!
But the we were in town for a gig at the Roxy, and he came and picked me up after soundcheck, and we went and had some pizza with the kids, with Brian and Robin, and
no, that's all right.
And I think that the fun thing I remember was I was in John's den in the house, and his wife Lori came in, and we were laughing about something, and she couldn't tell my laugh from his.
Yeah, you know, it was the same thing when I found my father. Our handwriting is identical. He's a pilot. I'm a pilot. He was a 2-time Distinguished Flying Cross recipient. We finished each other's sentences. We were into the same corny jokes and practical, you know, joke type thing.
Right.
And you know, it's like basically kind of going out of a cold winter day into a jacuzzi where you step into a hot jacuzzi and you go, because you're a little afraid of what is this going to mean? What kind of Pandora's box am I opening here? And then when you get in, it kind of goes,
It answered a lot of questions. It answered a lot of questions about nature versus nurture.
Nurture. Me too. We're experts on it, David.
Yes, we are
experts.
And there's something to be said for both sides of it. It proved to me I was genetically predisposed towards music.
Mm-hmm.
With Nancy and her relation to Johnny Mercer and that mm-hmm. whole business, and of course John and his incredible talents puts me away as far as knowledge of music and chops and ability.
I wouldn't say that. I think you both are expert in your own fields.
Well, he's old school, and I wish I knew what he knows. But we have a lot to give each other, and it's a good thing. We have a lot of fun.
I have to say, it reminds me of a really wonderful story that also happened with a friend of mine by the name of David Crosby. When he was about to have his liver transplant, the adoptive father of one of David's long-lost sons told David's biological son that David knew he had but had lost contact with, that David was dying. And, by the way, your father is David Crosby. The guy's name was James Raymond, and he was playing with, everybody. He was already an established musician. So James, at the same time that I found my father, David, James found his father, David, and that also coincides with the same time that David found John. And I'm just thinking about this whole connection here about
David,
children having found our families all at the same time come back to haunt them. But anyway, David and James later went on to record a great album, and they wrote a song together called Morrison, and I'll never forget the day that David called me up and said, "You got to listen to this. This is my son." And he told me about how he'd found James and how James also saved him, too, gave him reason for living. Because I'll tell you what, getting out of that liver transplant was very hard for him. And James was a big part of his recovery, just the same way that David was a big part of your recovery.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, they ended up recording an album together, CPR, and James wrote a song called Morrison, and David wrote the words about Jim Morrison.
It's confusing.
And about the movie. I know, it's getting really confusing, but I had to share that with everybody because this is a great, great album. This is David Crosby and his son, James Raymond, on a new release, CPR, and the song's called Morrison. It's just fabulous. By the way, this is a live at the Wiltern album. David Crosby and his son James Raymond playing keyboards. And Stephen DeStanislaus on the drums, percussion and vocals. And Jeff Pavar on lead guitar and vocals. back to Widespread Panic. Little Kin.
This is John R. and the Blue Power Hour with my co-host, J.C., and we're speaking today with our special guest, Mr. David Schools from Widespread Panic.
Glad to be here.
And enjoying the heck out of it.
Oh, yeah.
I am.
Oh, yeah. We're having a good time here. Who else we got here?
Well, we also have Drake Macy here. Drake Pappy Macy. Just, well, he's being shy and he's trying to pretend like he's not here. He's trying to blend into the walls. He's also one of the foremost bluesmen of the Midwest, as we all know, Pappy Macy.
Yeah.
From this side up, and just great bluesman. Hi, Pappy. Nice
to
have you here.
It's been a pleasure for me to be here all day.
Good.
We love it here at Blue Power. Everybody drops in. They just stop by, say hi, how you doing?
Dogs under the console.
Absolutely.
It's a good old southern down-home feeling here on the West Coast.
Strictly southern.
That's right. Just you wait and see. Boiled peanuts for the world.
That's right.
Now, did you buy your new home in Georgia?
Yes, ma'am, I did.
Yes, ma'am, I did.
I sure did.
Yes,
ma'am.
He bought it in just outside Athens.
It's about 7 minutes from downtown, 4 acres.
Unbelievable.
4 acres.
It takes me 2 days to cut the grass.
I'm telling you, you know what? If you have 4 acres, you really should go out and just get yourself a secondhand set of golf clubs and start hitting the golf balls around.
I got.
You and me, totally.
You know, exactly. I'm telling you, 4 acres is like your own private reserve.
I could have a chipping range out there.
Yeah, sure you could. That's great.
Jeannie, you look out the front of his house, and there's a small lake in the front. With picnic like benches out
water
there.
Water hazard.
Right?
Water hazard.
See, we see lake, she sees water hazard.
Right. behind the house is a creek. Absolutely beautiful.
Wow.
Well, you know, if you could get real estate like that out here for what I do out there, it would be a different world.
I'm not going to ask you how much you paid for it because I don't want to get sick to my stomach.
You couldn't rent a shack for what I paid for that place out here.
Oh. Yeah. Well, basically, I'm living in one for about, Let me ask you something. How many bedrooms, how many baths?
Four bedrooms, three baths.
And did you bring in an interior decorator?
No, it is a classic 1974 cedar.
Yeah. Cedar, but tell me the carpet is not avocado green or brown.
Well, it
please,
started off
brown shag,
it started off as white, but it is brown by now. I'm going to have a carpet replacement party when I get back from this tour, and everybody's going to trash it.
Yeah.
But I have a studio in the basement.
Yeah. You know? Do you really? What did you put in it? Did you put analog or digital? Or
it's an interface of both, because I think that's the way to go.
That's the way to go.
That's the best of both worlds.
2-inch analog and some, ADATs or DA98s?
Actually, I have straight to hard drive. I have a Roland 8-track.
Really?
And I have a big old gateway computer that's good for desktop composing, although any desktop composer.
What kind of processor?
No processor yet.
Really?
I don't have any, I don't have Cakewalk or Creamware or any of that stuff.
Trust me, on Cakewalk, it's really hard getting going on that. But once you get going on it, it's cool.
I've been using a program called Acid.
Acid is great. Acid will train you for Cakewalk.
It's very easy.
It's really good.
But I also have an old Gretsch drum kit. I have the Hammond B3 organ we used to carry, a Whirly. Mm-hmm. That my friend Kelly got at a flea market for $60.
Oh, my God.
Unbelievable.
This is the way the South is, folks. I mean, come visit us sometime.
Or certainly come there to buy instruments anyway.
J&J Center. You got to get there at 6:30 in the morning on Friday and Saturday if you want to get the Wurlitzer for $60. Otherwise, it's, puppies and things like that.
Puppies.
What's left? But it's great. And, we want to talk about the South a little bit and our involvement in the South and I'm just going to go ahead and your job here, because we know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
When John Herman joined the band in 1991 to be the keyboardist, we sort of got him from a band called Beanland that was named after General Beanland. Mm-hmm. He was in Oxford, Mississippi, which is where Ole Miss is. Now, JoJo came from New York City from a relatively affluent background. He went down there because he's a lover of the blues.
Mm-hmm.
And what he discovered is that there's a town called Holly Springs, about a half an hour away from Oxford, where he found Junior Kimbrough and R.L. Burnside, who everyone should be made aware of, and maybe we can do a later show on Fat Possum Records exclusively.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But he got together with his friend Matthew, and they started this little label with Robert Palmer, the critic, God rest his soul.
Mm-hmm.
And the first record they did was Junior Kimbrough's All Night Long. Junior, God rest his soul, has passed on. But what he taught us was that there is a definite connection between the Delta blues and African music.
Well, of course.
It's very circular. It's very hypnotic, very polyrhythmic. It is not your classy, Chicago-style blues.
Even call and response in some cases, too.
Yeah.
That's just field calling, hog calling, that's all.
Field hollers.
Field hollers.
Front porch music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we started, we tried to bring these guys to our fans. We've done shows with R.L. We've done shows with Junior Kimbrough.
How do your fans respond to them?
I think out of respect more than you know, it's hard to get the average age of the Widespread Panic fan. Is it probably, you know, 18 to 21?
Mm-hmm.
Were you into legitimate blues at that point? You know, maybe you've seen the Blues Brothers movie or something, and you like She Caught the Katie and Flip Flop Fly, songs like that.
Right,
but
right.
We're talking about just
serious,
the serious roots of it all.
These are people who, you know, they got nothing but the blues,
mm-hmm.
and it is the real thing. And thankfully, JoJo has a, you know, Fat Possum is distributed by Epitaph at this point, and a lot of that music gets out. R.L. Burnside did a record with John Spencer, who is an icon to the college mm-hmm. and the indie rock kids.
Mm-hmm.
I think people, a lot of the punks have turned on to the blues because if they don't kill themselves or burn themselves out, there's really nothing left after all that anger but the blues.
Yeah.
Well, not only that, but most of the blues people that you know that are really hardcore blues people are basically punks and of a different generation.
Exactly.
We're all
it's,
punks.
It's still some anger and it's got to go somewhere. And what
a rage
better way?
Of some sort that drives you into this. Three, you know, this basic setup of chords that exists eternally.
Plus, you know, we have a totally new audience, and it always amazes me when I get email from a 15-year-old
mm-hmm.
that tells me that he thought the Rolling Stones wrote "It's All Over Now" instead of, you know, the Valentinos,
right?
Don't feel bad, kid. So did I.
That's a real good example.
Until I started doing the show.
The Genie, this next cut, which is on Fat Possum, by the way, mm-hmm. and it's Elmo Williams and Hezekiah Early. The title of the CD is Takes One to Know One. Now, this is funny because I always thought this was a joke. It says tracks 4, 6, 7, and 8, track 8, which we're going to play, called mm-hmm. Match as Fire, was recorded at the Manning Tractor Shed in Waterproof, Louisiana.
This is recorded in a tractor shed?
In a tractor shed in Waterproof, Louisiana. There it is.
Waterproof,
I believe it. Yeah, I believe it.
Plum Nellie, Tennessee, and Waterproof, Louisiana.
I'm gonna keep running Mississippi.
That's right.
I think we ought to cut into this and find out what this sounds
Let's
like.
Let's do it.
Let's check into it.
Have you ever heard about the fire that happened way down in that Mississippi town? Have you ever heard about the fire that happened way down in that Mississippi town? I was standing there when old Bill and Boy down to the ground. Lucille was there. Lula Mae was there. Willie Mae had just walked downtown. You ever heard about the fire that happened way down in that Mississippi town? Standing there when the old building burned down to the down. Have you ever heard about the fire that happened way down in that Mississippi town? I was standing there when the old building burned down to the ground. We'll be right back.
My God. Now, that's the dirtiest guitar I ever heard.
That's
in my
the real
life.
Thing. That's what you find on Fat Possum Records.
Absolutely.
You're sitting there picturing this, like, old wooden, broken down tractor shed with light beaming in, dirt filtering in, or maybe a fan somewhere, sweaty old bandanas on the drums and stuff.
Yeah. All songs published by Big Legal Mess Publishing Limited.
That's perfect. Well, you know, the title of the last Junior Kimbrough record is Most Things Haven't Worked Out.
Ah.
And I think that pretty much sums up the position, you know, and where these most of these guys are coming from. They've been exploited, if they've ever had a chance or to get a break. And, you know, the great thing about Fat Possum is that they give so much more money to the artists.
Yeah.
They really do take a personal care kind of approach with these guys, and I think it's deservedly so, and I think that... you know, blues aficionados should be aware of this
can,
label.
Can you educate? You guys are so educated on the music scene. Let me ask you something. Every time a major actor dies, they always said he died at this, you know, SAG Actors Home or whatever that they
Screen
have.
Screen Actors, old actors,
some old folks home for actors.
Yeah.
Have we musicians set up any kind of foundation or any kind of thing?
I know
for
my
just musicians.
My
like
union
old
fee gets
home?
Me a pine box.
A pine box.
Exactly. No, but I think that I can't remember who it was. Someone
Somebody, yes.
is working on something like that, and it's an old folks home for musicians who didn't make wise investments.
Is that like?
Well, does that sound like 99% of musicians?
Oh yeah.
We don't like to use the word naive, but
and naive, innocent, and grateful for an opportunity to have some good things, and then you go out and get the good things, and then all of a sudden, it's over.
That's right.
Man,
it's gone.
It's
your 15 minutes, you know.
15 minutes is over.
So listen, David. Since this will be aired on approximately July 30th. Where will you be, and what will be going on?
We will have just finished this tour. The record will come out on the 27th, Till the Medicine Takes. We will be sharing time with our families, resting up for our trip to Europe, which
Excellent.
Is consuming most of August.
All right.
Us.
Tell us about that.
Well, Bombs and Butterflies, which you heard a cut from earlier, was the first record to get European and Australian distribution. So rather than tool around the Northeast and plow our way through snow and have people skiing to our gigs, we chose to go to Australia where it's summertime.
Yeah.
Good idea.
So we went to Australia and New Zealand for a couple of weeks, and then we went and did Paris, Amsterdam, Hamburg, and we got a really good response, especially in Germany, which apparently is the key to Europe from a business point of view. We don't care about that, but we'll play anywhere we can. We went back about 2 months later. And I did a bunch of festivals in Germany, the Hurricane Fest with Iggy Pop and the Lorelei Festival with Santana.
Oh, wow.
And went back to Paris.
Cool lineup.
Yeah, it was. Does the Europeans know how
Wait,
to do a
Iggy
festival?
Iggy Pop and Santana?
Two separate days.
Oh,
but
my God.
Still.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
Well, the lineup at this Hurricane Festival was like us, Dave Matthews, Chumbawamba, Bjork, Garbage, Beastie Boys, Iggy Pop. On and on and on. A great assortment of music. Everybody has a great time. That's how they do it over there, summer festivals.
Well, that's how Jazz Fest was this year, too, pretty much.
Exactly.
Great assortment.
Why do you have to be niched? Just because record companies would prefer you to be that way as a consumer doesn't mean that, you know, you're not allowed to like Bjork as well as Iggy Pop, as well as Widespread Panic.
Yeah.
If you like music, you search for a spark.
Yeah.
You know, and that's right. You know, it's easy to tell what doesn't have a spark and what does. It doesn't have to be any brand. But so we'll go back in August, and we're doing like probably 10 shows in Germany.
Going to do the Rock Palace again?
We're doing something. I haven't really even seen, you know, at this point, just put me on the bus and take me there. I will get off and I will play with a smile on my face.
Yeah.
My girlfriend can have the itinerary.
She'll call you and tell you where you are when you wake up.
Exactly.
Honey, I think today is Tuesday and you must be Belgium, right?
You're 7 hours ahead of me today, so how does tomorrow look?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it must be very exciting to have the ability and to play in all these places for all these different people.
It's great. You know, if there's one international language, it really is music.
Absolutely.
You don't have to speak English to enjoy it, even though a lot of foreign musicians choose to sing in English. Music is music, and everybody can tap their feet if they want to.
Can I ask you a question? Do the fans in Germany relate to the music as your fans do here in America?
But Germany especially. In Germany, there are still hippies.
Yeah.
You know, Parisians.
Not only that, but they speak beautiful English. Most of the Germans that I've met of this generation of the 18 to 21-year-olds speak beautiful English.
Well, you were just there, too, weren't you, Jim?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've done a lot of work there. You know, I mean, it's been involved there over, God, over 20 years. But I have to say that the Germans have got it hands down when it comes to educating people in bilingualism at the minimum. But they are bilingual at minimum and usually trilingual.
Exactly.
And their English is impeccable.
If there's one thing,
absolutely amazed.
If there's one thing that can be said about Germans as far as ethnic stereotypes go, they deserve theirs more than any other culture. Their attention to detail is what they stand behind, and you can count on them to know everything inside out, whether it's engineering or what.
Right, but we agree they are the most tolerant.
They are, but you know what? They'll tell you exactly what they think. We did our first show in Hamburg, and it was funny because it was April Fool's Day, which they don't celebrate over there. We had about 200 fans from the States on tour with us in Europe. They decided to play an April Fool's joke on us when we took the stage. They booed for a minute. They booed us for a minute. The president of PolyGram Germany was there. Everyone from down on from him.
No, they didn't.
And as soon as they got done booing, you know, then they started screaming April Fool's. Well, we got it, but I don't know if our record company guys got it over there. But after the show, which was bereft with shitty rental, excuse me, can I say that?
Of course you can.
I'm sorry. Terrible rental gear, which didn't work and failed us completely. You know, we were back in the dressing room knowing that we really hadn't played the greatest show. Our friend, the core of our German fan, this guy Rolf, comes in and he goes, "Well, I've seen maybe 10 shows on this tour so far, and that was the worst." So you're disappointed. You must be crushed, yeah? He says, "You must be crushed."
Crushed.
We're like, well, you know, we're a little more professional than being crushed at this point. But that's how they are. And, you know, to get back to the whole point of it, is that they do pay attention. So they like us because our fans pay attention to every detail. And we're really looking forward to going back. It's going to be terrific.
Mm-hmm. Well, excellent. Well, listen, we're going to take the show out now. I want to thank you very much for joining us today, David.
It's been very pleasurable.
And we're going to play a cut from from the new CD, Till the Medicine Takes.
It's all-time low, featuring the golden voice of Dottie Peoples.
Excellent.
Well, you know what?
Yeah.
It's getting close to that time, and we really should take some second here to mention something, okay?
Yeah.
I would like to welcome everybody back to BluePower.com. Please send us your emails. And all along I've been wanting to say this. We would like to welcome Michael Toth, our new Chief Technical Officer for the Blue Power Hour.
In San Francisco.
Welcome aboard. And Alec Pigelson, he's our new Chief Financial Officer.
Right,
David Kimmelman.
Union, yeah, he's from Union Bank.
Marketing Director. There's a great team behind BluePower.com.
Absolutely.
And we are really proud to be together. And we are so proud today to have had David Schools, bass player of Widespread Panic, and family member.
Absolutely. My main man.
Yeah.
Old man.
We're all going to head on out to the House of Blues tonight and see David play. Father gets to watch his son in action.
That's right.
Great moment.
Play the bass bigger than me.
Yes, indeed. It's BluePower.com. Come back and see us again. We got some more stuff coming up pretty soon.
We love you.
Take care. See you, John.
See you, Jeannie. Bye, David.
See you, David.
Bye, guys. Thanks.
You got it.